So what I would like to talk about today, I mean, it's something that bothered me a while ago, is actually when I was studying philosophy of probability, and I didn't know much about probability or quantum mechanics, but I had a great teacher, Itamar Pitofsky. And in the course, it was a long time ago, so about 1990, I think. In the course, he mentioned, he talked about interpretation of probability in relation to quantum mechanics. And one of the interpretation that he talked about is the finitis, very subjective, extremely subjective probability. And he suggested that there might be a problem in applying this interpretation to quantum mechanics. So what I would like to talk about is, first, I mean, try to explain, to make sense of his worry, because I think that it's also related to the work of another important work on probability in quantum mechanics. Itamar Pitofsky wrote a book on probability in quantum mechanics, Polytopes, those of you who know, and I think is very interesting and important, but also Arthur Fine worked on Bell inequality. So I think they have somewhat similar view, I would say, about this. And so the first part, I will try to motivate why there was a worry. And then in the second part, I will develop the interpretation of I will present the interpretation of probability, and then try to show how one can apply it to quantum mechanics. Now, the interesting thing is that my understanding of the finitis is different from the normal understanding. So you get a probability theory which is not classical in some sense. And so we will see. So that's the finitis, very important, one of the founding fathers of modern subjective probability, together with Ramsey. And they actually developed the ideas independently, so it's interesting, about the same time, mid to late 20s they started. Okay, so this is the structure of the talk. I mean, the first part would be section 1 and 2. So the first part, I mean, would be more general motivation. The second one would be consideration of probability in relation to Bell's theorem. What is Bell's theorem about? There is a debate whether it's about probabilities or about causality or whatever. And then the second part, section 3 or 5, we'll be trying to see how the finitis applies to quantum mechanics. So, okay. So the background was a course in philosophy of probability, and the question that Itamar posed, I mean, was whether an extreme subjective interpretation probability, whether the finitis probability could be applied to quantum mechanics. That was before people actually talked about it much. I think Chris Fuchs and his associate and other people, I mean, started in the mid-90s, I mean, to think about this, if I'm correct. So it was kind of surprising, and there wasn't much about it. Now, he wasn't worried about the fact that the finitis is very extreme. He says probability doesn't exist in the world. It's only uncertainty. And the interesting thing that he can go a long way with that and prove a lot of things. So that wasn't the problem. The problem was more about the question of whether a classical probability theory could be compatible with the non-classical structure of quantum probabilities. So just leaving aside the fact that it's extreme, that's not part of the point. So it's more the logic of probability in quantum mechanics, in a sense. So it was in the context of the EPR experiment, the Clausen and Horn version of the EPR. So you have like a particle, let's say in the singlet state, they are entangled, and one can measure spins in different direction on each of the particle, and the spin are incompatible. So spin in direction A and direction A prime on the left particle, and B and B prime on the right particle. And then you just look at the probability of outcomes and the correlation between them. Bell's idea was, I mean, now, the particles, I mean, the measurement, as we know, the measurement outcomes are curiously correlated. even if it's at a distance, and doesn't matter according to quantum mechanics how far it is, and it seems like unreasonable to think that there is some signal going in between, but still they are correlated in a strange way, which suggests that there is some non-local influence, and now we call it causality, although causality is a very ambiguous notion. And Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen thought that it's due to the incompleteness of quantum mechanics rather than some causation between the measurement outcomes in the left wing and the right wing of the experiment. And Bell, I think, in his model, I mean, tried to make sense of the ideas that EPR had in mind. And basically, the idea is that correlation have causal explanation, either correlation between distance event, either they are either because of causal direct causal connection between them, or because of a common cause. And if the correlation are due to the common cause, if the particle somehow correlated because of the way they are preparing the source, and they don't influence each other later on, then there would be a local explanation, local meaning no superluminal causation of the correlation between the outcomes. So Bell gives the example of you have black and pink socks, and they are in a box, and you send one to New York and the other one to London, and you know that one of them has to be black and the other one pink. So I mean, you discover you're black, you know that the other one is pink, there is no action at a distance, so nothing strange is going on. Okay, so the model that Bell had in mind, the local model that are supposed to reproduce the quantum statistics, have basically two main assumptions. One of them is that the probability of outcome given some complete state, I mean, EPR thought that the state, the quantum state, is an incomplete state of the particle. If there was a complete state of the particle, then given these states, the probability of outcome would factorize, meaning that there would be just the joint probability of outcome would be just the product of the probability of each of them. Something that doesn't happen when we take instead of lambda, which is supposed to be the complete state, if we take just quantum state. So that's one condition. The other condition, which seems very plausible, is that, I mean, there could be different complete states in any given non-complete quantum states. So there is a distribution over these complete states. And the idea is that it doesn't depend on which type of measurements we make. So whatever measurements we make, whether we decide to measure in the A direction or A prime direction or B prime or not to measure at all, the distribution will be the same. Because we can also decide the measurement, which measurement we make at the last moment, and to think that there is a correlation between the type of measurement that we make, I mean, or the type of measurement that we make, I mean, somehow is relevant to the distribution of the state of the particles at the source, would mean either that there is a backward causation or there is some kind of conspiracy, usually, I mean, it's called. Anyway, these two conditions are sufficient to derive certain probabilistic inequalities, certain relation between probabilities that turns, these are the Bell inequalities, that turn out to be they turn out to violate the quantum statistics, the probabilities of quantum mechanics. So basically, we know that one of these conditions has to go if we want a quantum theory. But anyway, these two assumptions, so I will show you, I mean, the inequalities later. So at the moment, I mean, it's just certain relation between probabilities of outcomes. And the point is that these two conditions leads to certain constraint on the probability of outcome that are incompatible with the constraint of quantum mechanics.
So is the lambda independence equivalent to the way that it's now formulated in the integral over the space of lambda?
Yes. Yes.
Equivalent to the distance of tracking across the
Yes, that you integral over, over lambda without worrying about, which measurement you make. Because otherwise, if that's violated, you can still have, even with this condition of locality, you can still have the quantum correlation. It's not explicit in Bell, but yeah.
What is the size?
The size, the quantum state. Well, it has, but the distribution of the, it's quite implausible to have a theory, quantum theory, in which the hidden variable is not dependent on the quantum state, the distribution.
The question is supposed to be about whether this hidden variable theory can underlie the quantum phenomenon. I would have just written that there without the sign, which is what you're saying, the distribution
of the hidden
state.
But. Yeah, psi, you can think about preparation that give rise to psi. It's just to make things easy. It's not the center of my talk. If you want, just do some preparation instead. But the probability of, and you can think about the quantum state just as an ignorance state. So that just point out to some other things. So it's not a big deal, but it has to depend somehow on quantum state one way or another. Otherwise, I think it's very difficult, to build such a theory. Anyway, it's not so important. We can come back to it later. The point, is that lambda independence, these states, this condition seems to be very reasonable. And almost nobody except for a small group of people, question it. Those who think about, for instance, I know that Aronov talked about the two states, interpretation, this violates, this condition. So if you have a theory that has both forward and backward causation, then there is a violation of this condition. But, otherwise, most of the people just take it for granted. And if you take it for granted, then it means that the quantum mechanics or any alternative theory, hidden variable, or however you want to call it, will have to violate factorizability. And the violation of factorizability is usually commonly considered or interpreted as some kind of non-locality. Because factorizability is supposed to be a locality condition. OK, there are dissenting views. And one of them, so there was Nancy Cartwright. There were a number of people who say that factorizability is not a locality condition. And there is the view that Artur Fein expressed that that probabilities correlation need not have causal explanation. But I want to focus actually on some other challenge that he has and some other view. And his view is that the Bell's theorem, as I presented it, is about non-locality. It's supposed to show that quantum theory is supposed to be non-local, while Artur Fein thinks that it's not about that, that basically what we are assuming is a joint distribution over a hidden variable. And the hidden variable in our experiment, you can think about all the different kinds of spin that you can measure. So if you can measure spin in direction x or y on the left particle and y and z on the right particle, so you assume that there is a distribution over all these four spins, a joint distribution. Which in quantum mechanics doesn't exist because they are incompatible properties. Spin x and y on the same particle are incompatible properties, so there is no probability of the particle having spin x up and spin y down, for instance. Okay, so just quotation, I think it's very clear what he says. He says that So basically what he's saying, that what Bell did, in disguise, is assuming a joint probability distribution. And what he shows is, and something that you, that is really the rejection of which is the essence of quantum mechanics, that there cannot be such a joint probability. Okay, so his word, the first, so, and then he proves, he proves mathematically some theorems in three papers in 1982 that I think were influential, that are supposed to show certain things about the relationship between hidden variable model and joint distribution. And the first result is to show that the existence of deterministic hidden variable is strictly equivalent to the existence of joint distribution probability. PA, you can think about A as spin of the left particle in the A direction, A prime spin up of the particle in the A prime direction, and the same for, and B and B prime are for the R particle, the relation B and B prime. For the four observable of the experiment, so these are spins it could be generalized, but he actually focuses on spin. One, they return the probability of the experiment as marginal. So the hidden variables are the spin. The particles are supposed to have spins even before the measurement, although according to the quantum state, they don't have any definite spin. The singlet state, the particle have no definite spin in any direction before the measurements. Okay, and then he says necessary and sufficient for the existence of deterministic hidden variable model is that Bell, Clausen-Norrin inequality is one version of the Bell inequalities, these probabilistic inequality that I will talk about in a minute, hold for the experiment. So we have first, that it's equivalent to have a joint probability and having hidden variable, deterministic hidden variable. Now we have another thing, that it's equivalent to say that there is a deterministic hidden variable and that there are the Bell inequalities holding. And the third condition is the stochastic hidden variable exists if and only if there is a deterministic hidden variable. So basically what we get, if you believe my logic, that the existence of a joint distribution over the four hidden variables, the spins, is equivalent to the satisfaction of Bell and Clausen inequality, and this is also equivalent to the existence of deterministic and indeterministic hidden variable model. Okay? And that's a mathematical result, actually. I mean, what he does, I mean, I think that theorem is fine, mathematically speaking, is fine. Well, given the assumption, the implicit assumption that he has, yes, they are. But I agree that there is some way of, some interpretation or some implicit assumption. But what is important for me is that the existence of joint probability over A prime, B and B prime, which are the spins before the measurements of the left particle, two spins of the left particle and two spins, two incompatible spins of the left particle and two incompatible spins of the right particle, equivalent to this inequality that I'm going to talk about in a moment. Okay? Is it clear so far? I mean, that's really important. Okay. Now, leave quantum mechanics. Let's talk about the finetti, and then we connect it and we see what was the challenge that Itamar Pitofsky had in mind. So just to say something about Fine's reasoning, Arthur Fine's reasoning, Itamar Pitofsky had, I think, similar view in mind, that at that time, Bell inequalities, is about joint probability at the end of the day. Okay, so the finetti maintained that degrees of belief, that probabilities are based on degrees of beliefs. So we are ignorant about things, and it doesn't matter why we are ignorant, just because we are lazy or we don't know or there is no answer, it doesn't matter. And then we have degrees of belief, and if degrees of beliefs are coherent, they satisfy the probability axioms and theorems. And basically, the coherent degrees of belief in things that we are uncertain about are probabilities. So basically, our probability theory is just coherence, being coherent about your degrees of belief, your partial beliefs, not full beliefs. Now, this is usually expressed by the idea that degrees of belief should be represented by probability functions. So if you want to be coherent, you want your degrees of belief to be represented by a probability function. And many times it is assumed, though implicitly, that agents have one probability function that over all the degrees of belief that they have, I mean, in whatever. So, you know, some could be about quantum mechanics, some could be about, you know, their life, they want to buy a house, they think about, I mean, the share, I mean, the prices in the market and so on. And if you want, I mean, examples, I think two notable examples, one is David Lewis. If you see in his paper, basically, I mean, he implicitly presupposes it, and another person is what's his name, Carnap. But yeah, we will see. I mean, when you see the finite interpretation, you will see what it means. But the idea is that you know, I have different. I'm uncertain about a lot of things, and I put all these. So these are events or proposition about events. I put all this in my probability space, and now I have one probability function. And therefore I'm coherent about all the things that I'm uncertain about.
Yeah. So this is formally very similar to Pascal.
Yeah.
So are we allowed to say no everything?
I think one has to make the distinction between the normative and descriptive. I think that for the finetti, I mean, it's a normative thing. It's not that, you know, we really do it. So we have to learn probability in order to police our intuitive, you know.
There's a metaphysical assumption here about the future and reliability of the future.
Yes. Yes, but for the finite it doesn't matter because probability is not in the world. So you just have to be uncertain about something. It might not even exist.
But why am I not allowed to say I'm uncertain full stop and I try not to have to use the belief that satisfying the maximum.
Okay, yeah, I mean, you can have this view, and some people have this view, but it's the minority, actually, among the philosophers. I think that people think that is to have probability is to be rational, and if you don't have probability, it means that you are incoherent. You know, it's like saying, you ask me, what's the probability of rain raining now? I say 50%. You ask me, what's the probability of not raining? I say 60%. That's being incoherent. Yes. No, but I mean, you can be ignorant about it. I mean, you don't know anything now, but you can be ignorant about it. You can bet on it. And I mean, anyway, I mean, I'm not going as extreme as economics. Yeah. Yes.
So you're giving an example of an inconsistent probability design that leads into the proposal.
Yes. But if you look at the subjectivist, and I think that it's fair to say that it's a common view, is they always think that there is a probability. It might not be a probability that is based on some good, you know, grounds, but there is always probability. Now, one of the things that I would try to suggest that the finetti thought otherwise. That they are not always, although he was subjectivist, he didn't think that they're always probability, but the question is why. But anyway, I think that talking about economics is a bit far-fetched because I don't think that it's realistic, I mean, to think any way along the economist.
At about the same time,
yeah.
In a related field, people are making formally analogous assumptions.
Yes, yes. I mean, basically, the founding fathers, I think that von Neumann and Morgenstern did, I mean, they did something that Ramsey did before, but maybe, you know, more sophisticated in some sense, but without, I think without knowing, maybe, I mean, but Ramsey already did it, and the finetti to some extent, yeah. Okay, so now, assuming that all your all the things that you are ignorant about, I mean, are represented by one probability function is basically assuming that there is a joint distribution over these things. So basically now I think I can introduce some in the worry that Itamar Pitofsky had. Now, if followers of the subjective interpretation were committed to the assumption that there is such a joint distribution, and if Arthur Fahn was right in his interpretation of Bell's theorem, it would follow from that that anyone who follows, I mean, this interpretation would be committed to the Bell Clausen-Noren inequality that I'm going to present in a moment, and therefore would never get the probabilities of quantum mechanics. Yeah. So what you're saying basically that the joint distribution is, I mean, doesn't explain Bell theorem.
Joint distribution of what thing? So there's probably both models of joint distribution. The other things
But the Bell's theorem is not about these things. The Bell's theorem is about measurement outcomes. If you have a joint probability, you have a joint probability over everything, the hidden variable and the measurement outcome. Well, measurement outcomes, I mean, you can think about it where the particle went in the Stern-Gerlach. That's enough. And there will be joint, if you assume that the agent has joint distribution and use the subjective probability, then you will get in any theory whatsoever. I mean, it's a theorem of probability theory that you will get, I mean, something like Bell inequality.
Maybe you have to.
Okay, I'll talk about it. I mean, I'm running really late. I mean, it's like 25 minutes and I'm not even halfway through. So, So I will talk about it when I. So is it clear, I mean, what is the challenge? So that was the challenge. I mean, it's not about and I think that it's an interesting subject, challenge, and I think one has to take it seriously because, in my view, Itamar is one of the experts on probability in quantum mechanics. I mean, if I know anything about this, I learned from him. Now, follower of the subjective probability may agree with Fine, with Arthur Fine, that Bell's theorem is not about non-locality, it's about probability, but for somehow decline, I mean, to assume that there is a joint distribution over all the, over all the things that they are uncertain about. But the question is whether they have a non-ad hoc reason to do. I will argue that if you follow the finitive, there is a non-ad hoc, independently of what you think about what Fine, But before getting to this issue, I want actually to analyze quickly Arthur Fine work and to show that I think he's wrong, in my view. Okay, so that's the second. The term Bell inequality is ambiguous. I mean, I can think at least about three different kinds of, and I'm talking about Bell, Clausen, and Noren inequality. So the notation, lambda is the hidden variable, I mean, the complete state of the particle pair in the EPR. A prime are the spin in two different directions of the left particle, and B and B prime are the spin in two different directions of the right particle before the measurements. These are the hidden variables, and the OA is the outcome up in the A direction on a spin measurement, and the same for OB or A prime and OB prime. A and B are the direction of the measurement, the setting of the measurement apparatus to measure spin in direction A and B in the direction B. Is it clear, the notation? Yes, the difference is that this is the model probability, the lambda is the model probability, and the psi is the quantum probability.
Yeah,
So these are about outcomes. These are actually closer to what we should call, I mean, Bell clouds and unknown or Bell inequalities. And this is a kind of strange, but I think that I will have an explanation why this is also called, I mean, Bell clouds and unknown inequality. But you can see the structural similarity. Anyway, the news from probability theory that this is a theorem of probability theory. Whatever A, B, A prime and B prime is, and whatever P is, this anything that is probability has to satisfy that. It's a mathematical result. And so if you have a joint probability over A prime, B and B prime, in a probability function, you will get this. It's interesting that it was actually discovered by a physicist, but it's nothing to do with physics. These two are not theorems of probability theory. Okay? And they don't follow from any assumption of joint distribution. And look at my notation. I mean, I wrote conditional probability with subscripts rather than after the conditionalization stock. And I think to make it explicit, that in these inequalities, there are six different probability functions. So there is no point in talking even about, you know, distribution in one function. From distribution in one function, you don't get anything. So R2Fine has to convince us that this can follow from a joint distribution, because this is the relevant for the experiment. At the end of the day, whatever comes before is irrelevant. And obviously, I mean, you can see now that it's impossible to do that without assuming some physical assumption. For instance, assuming that B, P, lambda, AB is equal to this probability. If you assume for each of these probability, then you can use you can use probability theory, and you need actually another assumption. You need also the lambda independence. You can go from this inequality of probability theory to this inequality. But otherwise, you cannot do that. Okay? Is that clear, the general? I mean, if we want, we can talk more about it. So let me say just quickly. So that's what I said. The first one is probability theory. The second one, okay. Now, as I mentioned, Bell derived this assumption, this inequality, not by joint distribution. He derived it by assuming factorizability and lambda independence, the locality condition. And both of these conditions do not assume joint probability. So you can see that it's not a necessary condition, joint probability, to get this inequality. That is not sufficient condition. It's easy because I can build a model, and in the paper that I sent you, there is a model, I mean, very simple model in which you have a joint probability that violates this. So it shows that it's not sufficient condition. Anyway, so now sometimes there is the temptation, and I added it because there was in some of the talks to say, okay, if you put after the conditionalization stroke, I mean, if you put everything that was in the subscript into the probability function, to probability space, then you have one probability function over everything. That's true, but the bad news for those who think that it's probability theory, that this is not a theorem of probability theory, nevertheless. You need unconditional probability to have, to derive it. So I think that if we want to talk about it more, we can talk later, but I think we can, put aside, the R2Fine worry. I mean, I just want to point out that one can get from, as I already hinted, one can get from this inequality, which is a assumption about joint distribution, to this inequality by two assumptions. One is that I call it mirror, that the distribution of outcome reflects the distribution of the spin before the measurement. So they mirror them for whatever reason. And the other one is that the distribution of the lambda is independent on the measurement apparatus, the lambda independence. Once you assume that, you can go from here to here. But these are two physical assumptions, and they are not unrelated to causality and non-locality. Okay. And they're actually violated. So if you want, to Lucian, you can think about A and B here as the position of the particle in Bohm's theory relative to the measurement apparatus. And in Bohm's theory, it does satisfy this assumption, if you think it is. But Bohm's theory violates the mirror assumption. Okay? So let's okay. So if it's okay, I must really rush into the finite. And so leave quantum mechanics for a moment and go to the finite and try to make my first idea. And the first idea, just to the main idea of that I had in the paper, in this paper a long time ago, is that that coherence on the finite is actually much more complicated than people think. And coherence depends on some verificationalism. So to be coherent is not just to be coherent in this, to be consistent. It really embodies some assumption about verificationalism. Now, one of the things that I will try to convince you that in his theory, verificationism make a very good sense, actually the best sense, if you're subjectivist on his view. So he was positivist, but I think that you can give a very good and straightforward justification even if you're not positivist. Okay, so the finite is very different from, I studied probability theory as a measure theory. So the first meeting, I mean, there was the assistant gave us like, so there was a lecture and then there were the tutorial and in the tutorial, in order to make it spicy, some paradox about, you know, probability. And then immediately we, after this paradox, we never thought about anything intuitive or non-intuitive, it was just a measure theory. So it doesn't matter whether you talk about probability or you talk about the length of tables. I mean, it's basically the same, you just normalize. The finite has a very different view. For the finite, the axioms of probability theory is very different from Kolmogorov. The axiom of probability theory have to follow from the notion of probability, the axioms and theorems. You cannot just postulate them. They have to follow from the notion. So that's very important. And as we should see, and that's the reason why he doesn't define, for instance, conditional probability just as a ratio. He actually derived it from his probability theory. The second thing that is important is that probability are inherently subjective. And probability is nothing about the world. It's just an expression, degrees of belief are expression of uncertainty, and probability is just making these degrees of belief coherent. That's all. It's nothing to do with the world, and it's not supposed to. I mean, a lot of less extreme subjectivists, like for instance, if you in the philosophy, I mean, literature, David Lewis would say subjective probability is supposed to be a guess about objective probability. So he has these principles called the principal principle, in which if the probability, your subjective probability of A, given that you believe or assume that the chance of A is half, should be half. For the finite, that doesn't make sense. You don't have objective probability, and you cannot have such conditional probability, and you cannot have such a principle. It's all subjective. Now, what is important is that, so just to see, so any probabilistic reasoning is always subjective, and it doesn't matter why, I mean, you are uncertain, it's because of uncertainty. The other thing is that this is, that probability is, it's an instrumental view. So his view is that probability is an instrument, is a guide for life, but it's only instrumental, not because it reflects anything in the world, because he thinks and he wants to convince us that it's a good instrument to police your ignorance. Yeah, that's the best way to police your ignorance. And therefore, it doesn't matter whether, I mean, the world is deterministic or indeterministic, whether you exist or don't, I mean, you know, whether you are brain in a vat or whatever. It's really, all these questions like in instrumental, if you have an instrumental interpretation of a theory, these things, I mean, are not relevant at all. Okay. Okay. And there is no fact in the world that could show that your probability is not right. I mean, at most, what facts could do is convince you, but psychologically, to change your mind about probability. But this is psychological. It's always go through your subjective, I mean, reasoning. There is no mechanical rule. Some of the Bayesian are looking for mechanical rules, but for definitely that was really not the thing to do. Okay, now the important, I mean, to get from this very subjective view, the probability theory, you have to impose, and that's the minimal rationality condition, and for him is actually the most important and the only one, is that degrees of beliefs are coherent. And the usual argument is that you say, if you're not coherent, I can sell you a Dutch book. And a Dutch book is a bet in which you lose come what may if you're incoherent. So yeah, just offer you, I mean, according to the bets that you take as fair. So suppose like your degree of belief in raining now is 50% and your degree of belief in not raining is 60%. I give you a series of bets in which whether it's raining or not, I mean, you're going to lose, come with me. So that's the point. So if you don't want to be in such a situation as Dutch book, you have to be coherent. In economics, I mean, it's sometimes called pumping money out of you.
Yes, but as in economics, when we just not accept, when we take the view, that there are things that will not bet on, what's one take the view that there are things that will bet on, that what they take the view that there are things that are the path of uncertainty that one wins.
But for definitely, you bet all the time. Whenever you cross the street, you bet in some sense because you know you have a degree of belief that, I mean, that the car comes or, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have the same sympathies as you. I mean, but I think it does make sense when you talk about the EPR, for instance. You know, but things are clear. APR experiments, and you know exactly what you're betting, and you can measure it, you know, in 5 minutes from now, or maybe a year. So when things are very,
sure.
Yeah. So that's enough for me. Yeah. Yeah. But yes, I agree. I mean, I have also. That's the reason why I'm not Bayesian, but still, I think it's important to understand what Definetti says because I think that what he says goes beyond Bayesian. That's the important thing. Okay, so that's the coherence. Now, Definetti also thought that it's very important to be able to measure degree of belief, given that they are so central, and given that they are like guide for life. I mean, they're basically the guide for life. And a number of philosophers of probability or founding fathers of different interpretations are the same. Okay, now. The Dutch book framework is a bit problematic because there is a bookie and there is an interaction between two people and there might be the temptation, I mean, to change your mind and not to reveal you true degrees of belief because of that. So Definetti actually, although many people talk about the Dutch book argument, he used, I mean, a different framework. And I just say it, I mean, very quickly talk about it. It's called the loss function. And the idea is that there is no bookie. You have your degrees of belief, but you are subjected to a certain loss function according to the difference between your degree of belief and whether the events that you bet on or you know, have degrees of belief in happen or they don't happen. If they happen, the EI is like a variable for these events, and if they happen is one, and if they don't happen is zero. And the idea is that if you are rational, you don't want to take any decision or any degrees of belief that would be dominated by other degrees of belief. So you want to be in a situation in which your loss is not always more than it should be, come what may. Okay, so it's similar to the Dutch book. I mean, it's similar to the Dutch book, but there is no bookie and there is no betting. You like bet against nature if you want. I mean, you know, you said, I mean, you don't want to enter. You like, I mean, you want to live and you always think about what should I do and accordingly. But anyway, I mean, it's not so important. I mean, in the paper is a bit more important for the probability theory, but just I will talk about it later. Okay. Now, another thing that is important for definite is to have an operational definition of probability so that you derive probability in operational terms, but the operationality here, I mean, is very important to emphasize, is not operationality a la Bridgman that you know. You define like probability in terms of operation, or you define temperature. What he means is basically that you should have some criterion about probability, I mean, a definition that will allow for a criterion for measurements of probabilities, okay? Okay, the last thing about probability before I go to talk about another important element of definitely and then back to quantum mechanics, is that conditional probability is usually defined as a ratio. So the probability of A given B is the probability of A and B divided by the probability of B. For definitely, that's not true. For the definitely probability, conditional probability is the probability that you have, the degree of belief that you have in A if you come to know B, if you come to know, assume, or believe B. But that's not a ratio. I mean, it's something, it's actually a primitive. If you want, it could be understood in two ways. One, as a conditional. For instance, when you say the probability of A given B is X, or 0.5, it's like saying, if A, then my probability of B would be 0.5, which is different. It doesn't always imply, actually, the ratio. It's only in certain situations imply the ratio definition as a coherent condition. Okay? So that's one thing. Another way that definitely, so that's this way. So one way, I mean, to say is like that conditional probability of E, that the probability of E given H is equal P, is to say that if I come to know or believe or assume H, then my probability of E would be P. And you can also use it as a counterfactual. I mean, suppose that H is just a counterfactual background knowledge. So say, if I had known or believed H, then my probability in E would have been P. Okay, so that's... Yes, but it's not counterfactual. I mean, I mean, it's more complicated. In the paper, I developed a little bit more these things. But the point is that it's not, it's a kind of conditional. Another way that definitely actually played with, I mean, an idea, is conditional events. So when you talk about the probability of E given H, it's like the unconditional probability of a conditional event, E conditional on H, which is basically a conditional proposition. It's the proposition, if H is true, then, so these conditional events is not a binary event. It's not true or false. It could be also indeterminate. So the idea is that if H is true, then the conditional event HA, E given H, depends on whether E is true. If it's true, then it's true. If E is false, it's false. But if H is false, then this conditional event is indeterminate or void. If you want, I mean, those of you who know about the Koloff bet, that's basically the idea of Koloff bet. And basically, it leads to a three-value logic and a probability theory over three-value logic. So it's already non-classical. But also in the first way is non-classical, but it's more difficult to see. So what I try to show here that his theory is in some sense already non-classical. Okay? Is it clear? I need another 10 minutes or so, if it's okay. Yeah, it's a bit long. Okay, so now they are different, these two ways of thinking about conditional probability are different. Interestingly, both of them are suggested in the text of Definetti. And in the eye of Definetti, they're actually very close to. And so that's a quotation from his book, It's Theory of Probability, 2 volumes, published in 1970 in Italian and then translated to English in 1974. So we shall write the probability of the event conditional, the event E should be the conditional on H, or even the probability of the conditional event EH, which is the probability that you attribute to E should be there, if in addition to your present information, which is usually suppressed, which we understand implicitly, it will become known to you that it is true, that H is true and nothing else. Sorry, I mean, I don't know where the H, yeah. That, pardon? No, that H is true, because it's a conditional probability. It's the probability of E if becomes known to you, or you assume H, in addition to your implicit background that you just suppress. Okay, so you can see that there is the conditional here, but on the other hand, he says, well, it's the same as talking about conditional events. And he has a long discussion in which he talks about Reichenbach tree-value logic in the context of quantum mechanics, and also other people who developed, I mean, tree-value logic and try to have a probability theory over there. Okay, so now to the punchline about probability in Definetti. He says Definetti is very important that you can verify the events. He wants to give probability only to events that are verifiable. Otherwise, it's not, there are no probabilities, basically. And I'll try to very briefly to explain why it makes sense in his view. But basically, he says it's always a question of examining if and in what sense a statement really constitutes an event, permitting in a more or less a realistic, acceptable form, and in a unique way, the verification of whether it's true or false. Now, it's interesting to make a distinction. Definetti is not subjectivist about events. He's subjectivist about probabilities. He's actually pretty realist about, he's a positivist, so he doesn't want to talk about things that have no meaning or, you know, you cannot verify. But I would suggest that actually it's important, although he's realist about events, it's important to have verifiable events for probability. Okay. Now, he acknowledged that verifiability, is kind of complicated and vague, and he doesn't discuss it. He took pragmatic attitude about, you know, what is verifiable or not. What I'm going to do, I just assume verifiability in principle in order to make things simple. Otherwise, it's too difficult. Okay. So he says, and that's a quotation from this book, it should be in English, it's 1974, A, B are event observable, but it is not possible to observe both of them, and therefore it's not possible to call the product A, B an event. Okay, so you can have an event A, you can have an event B, but A, B is not an event, at least for probability theory. Now, he's not saying that the event doesn't exist in the world. But what he's saying, basically, I'll give probabilities only to things that are verifiable. Okay, motivation. One thing is that is a positivist motivation. He thought that, you know, if you cannot verify, it could be just metaphysical notion of event. And then, you know, you may talk about nonsense, but think that it makes sense. The other one is that he thought that all notions that have a great practical importance have to be able to be measured, and therefore they have to be verifiable in one way or another. And that event and probability are examples. But 4 and 5 are the most important things. Remember, Definetti is extremely subjectivist and instrumentalist about probability. Probability doesn't exist I mean, you shouldn't ever think about whether you are right or not about probability, because it doesn't make sense. Now, think about, in this context, how do you make degrees of belief coherent? If you take the Dutch book, that's the easy framework. You have a Dutch book, and you want to convince me to be coherent. And you say, let's bet on event A, and know that event A is unverifiable. Okay? I said the probability is minus 0.2. Now show me that I'm not coherent. And you cannot, I mean, conclude this bet, no? So it doesn't make sense. It's basically the idea of coherence, given that coherence is defined in a decision theoretic framework, certain type, it doesn't make sense to talk about bets or decisions in that framework that are not that you cannot conclude. Now, the other loss function seems to suggest otherwise, because you can think have losses, I mean, even if you cannot verify, because there is no bet. But a little reflection would show that it's the same, because I shouldn't worry about any loss and being coherent if it's something that I will never verify. I mean, the point is that to be instrumental, it makes sense. Probability can be, if probability is subjective, it could be instrumental only if you can verify, at least in principle, the thing that you have probability of. If you cannot verify the implication of your degree of belief, you know, few action decisions, then it's not going to be tool for guidance for life. So I think that in the finite system, it does make a very good sense if you want to do, if you want to have probability to require a verificationism. And that doesn't mean that you cannot have degrees of belief, but degrees of beliefs are not probabilities. Probabilities are coherent degrees of beliefs. And you cannot, I mean, if you want, there is more in the paper explanation, but basically the idea is that you cannot make a good sense of coherence in unverifiable events in this framework, in this philosophy. Okay? Now, there are two ways to make it explicit, and by conditional. Yep. He's subjectivist all the way. So you have an assumption, you have a background assumption that tells you, I mean, this is your subjective background assumption, there is nothing beyond that. So you have, according, like, suppose in quantum mechanics, suppose I don't know quantum mechanics, but you tell me, and I'm convinced that you cannot measure spin in two different directions on the same particle at the same time. So I put it in my background knowledge. And then I say, well, I cannot measure spin X and Y on the particle at the same time. I cannot verify them. Therefore, there is a no joint probability of the two.
I might have the reason to believe, but we're not supposed to produce a joint probability in connection with those degrees of belief.
So degrees of belief you can have. Degrees of beliefs are not probabilities.
I'm trying to make that distinction. Yes. I'm just trying to get clear about what that is. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, probabilities are only of verifiable event, and it's always a matter, all probabilities are conditional. They're always conditional on your background knowledge or assumptions. And your background assumption would tell you, I mean, you know, or, whether it's verifiable or not. Now, you might be mistaken, but that's irrelevant. Then you can change your background. Okay, so there are two ways, I mean, but both of them are by conditional probability. Basically, what DeFinetti says, if you take the, remember, we can talk about conditional probability either three conditional events with three values or as a certain kind of conditional. So if you think about conditional events, you can say instead of giving probabilities or degrees of belief to events, you give probability degrees of belief always to event conditional on their observation, or at least conditional on that they can be verifiable. Okay? So then you can have probability of at the conditional event E1 conditional on H1, and you can have probability of the event E2 conditional on H2, but you might not have probability of E12, which is the conjunction of E1 and E2, conditional on H12. So that means that if you go this way, you have a probability theory, or your space of events have all these atomic events, but some of them have no joint probability. So you have a space of probability with holes, basically, which you can see it's already non-classical in that sense. Or you can, okay, so that's what I said. Or, one of them actually disappeared. Okay. The other way is to do the following. The other way, let me see. Okay, the other way that somehow disappeared here, I don't know why, it's transparently that I lost, is to think about in a different way, to have your degrees of belief represented by smaller probability spaces, each of which is such that all the events in it are jointly verifiable. And if you want, that's what I did when I wrote the probability with the subscript. That basically each subscript could identify probability space, and each subscript assume implicitly that, I mean, or if you want, there is an assumption there, the condition HI, that all the events in this probability, smaller probability space, are jointly verifiable, and they're just the classical probability space. But then the idea is that your ignorance, general ignorance, is divided into different probability spaces that need not have very close connection to each other. Okay. So that's the. But either way, if you go back to the Clausen and Ohm inequality, and you talk about the spin, remember A prime and B prime are spins in different direction, you don't get this probability inequality, because if you go with the three events, then you don't have joint probability of A prime and B prime, because they are not jointly verifiable. So in your probability space, there is a hole, and then you cannot derive this. If you have a hole, you cannot derive this inequality. If you go the other way, you will have here four different probability spaces, one for A and B, one for A prime and B, the other one from A and B prime, and the other one for A prime and B prime, and they will be separated. They won't constrain each other. So again, you will have basically what you are going to have, the coherent condition are going to be weaker. And because they are weaker, you have more flexibility with your probabilities. I mean, you can do more. So basically, yeah, it's, I have.
It's not their question, so.
Yeah, yes, I mean, I have just a conclusion, so.
Okay. One thing, it's three short points. I mean, one is an interesting point that's actually connected to objective probability, so I thought that. So one point is that it's actually, this kind of verificationalism seems to make sense even if you're not subjectivist. It's a kind of give you extra cushion. You know, if you don't know what's going on, if you cannot verify, don't give joint probability to something. And that immediately make your probability space different, non-classical in some sense. So that's one point. The second point is actually interesting with someone who had the view, George Bull, and that's a paper that Itamar published in 1994, Itamar Pitofsky. George Bull, I mean, he's known more for logic, but actually he had an important contribution to foundation of probability. And he had the idea, the notion that is called a condition of possible experience. Now, he thought about probability as a relative frequency in finite samples. So it's an objective probability. But he, but his condition of possible experience is basically the coherence condition that we usually think about. But they only apply in a sample that you can, in one sample, in things that you can sample jointly. So it's basically similar to what I said about the Finetti. If you cannot sample four events, I mean jointly, then the condition, the normal condition, the coherence condition would not apply. Okay, so I think that it's nicely, I mean, and that's, you know, 160 years before the Finetti. And the last thing is that actually, if you take the Finetti as the basis for your interpretation of quantum probabilities, then it's difficult to prove, it's difficult to argue for non-locality for two reasons. One is that if you have subjective probabilities, factorizability, remember the condition that the probability of joint outcome factorize, is very difficult to connect to causality because these probabilities are just extremely subjectivist. Have nothing to do with any causation and the other thing is that in lambda independence, the hidden variable is usually not verifiable in theories. It's actually the minority of hidden variable theory that you find that they're verifiable. Now, if they're not verifiable, you cannot give probabilities to lambda. And if you cannot give probability to lambda, you cannot even formulate lambda independence. So you cannot actually prove derive the inequality. So in a sense, in the context of the Finetti, it's very difficult to do the exercise that Bell did. Now that shouldn't be surprising because if you are extremely subjectivist, your probability should not reflect anything about causality or non-locality. So that's the end. Thanks. Sorry for being too long.
Questions? Anybody at Western, too?
No questions here. Thanks.
I'm very confused. It's not possible for me to have a degree of belief about the existence about something ontological like the existence of hidden variables such that the condition of factorizability is something I believe in. And supposing my degree of belief of factorizability is 1. Because that's my belief, and doesn't that come before these considerations?
You can have degrees of belief, but it's not probability. For probability, you need coherence, and coherence requires verifiability. So degree of belief is not probability.
So
probability
is my version of verifiability is in 500 years in the future, there will have been other experiments that I can't predict right now that would have verified the existence of these hidden variables.
Yes, but the point is of the hidden variable, many times the hidden variable theories are such that you cannot verify the value of the hidden variable. Correct?
But all
the majority of cases.
Well, all I need is to verify my assumption that objectively they exist, and then I can use them in a way you're not committing to.
But it's not enough, because in order to have the distribution over the hidden variable, you have to have the distribution is over different values of the hidden variable.
Right, but there might be five experiments in the future that we can't think about now. We have not had the imagination to invent that would probe that probability distribution.
I thought that the problem is think about Bohm's theory, for instance. Bohm's theory. So the Bohm's theory, the lambda, would be the quantum state and the position of the particle, the joint of them. No? Okay, now if you want to measure the quantum states, you change the position. If you measure the position, you change the quantum state. So there is no, if I'm not wrong, I mean, you cannot have any, in principle, you cannot have an experiment in which you can get both of them, the value of both of them.
You don't measure the quantum state either, you measure the other.
But the hidden variable in most of the theory, the hidden variable is the quantum state plus something.
But what? Well, it's the state. I mean, I don't know what counts as hidden. I mean, the non-hiddenness is in the outcomes, the results of the experiments, and that's what we observe.
I'm not.
I mean, I never see
the point.
I never see a position in the far from me to think.
No, but, but very explicitly, if I follow Andrew Valentini, if I had a system which was, quote, out of equilibrium, then I could measure all those things.
I mean, I think what you're saying might be right, but if his point is that for theories that will consistently agree with quantum theory, you can't get a Bell argument, then there's a problem. And what you're talking about, saying, which in the future will disagree with quantum theory, you're talking about a class of theories where quantum theory is not right.
Well, because the fact that, on the outcome that quantum theory A is incorrect, and B, there will be experiments in the future that allow me to measure the values of hidden variables, which we have not yet invented. Why am I not allowed to have to try and make coherent my degrees of belief about future theories?
But you're saying, you're
saying Bell's theorem. Bell's theorem is a theorem about quantum theory, rather than about some future theory.
But my point is, definitely would not say that, you cannot have a bet about what happened 500 years from now, because someone may be able to measure it, so it's verifiable, at least in principle. But if you are in equilibrium, then it seems that you cannot measure, this in principle, you cannot measure the hidden variable. Now, if you are out of equilibrium, then there are other things you can use, for instance, signal, or you can have some other information that would let you know at least indirectly, where you are. So it's a different situation. But following what Lucian said, in most, hidden variable theories of quantum mechanics, it turns out that the lambda is something that you cannot verify.
As opposed to, can I ask you?
Yeah.
As opposed to ordinary quantum mechanics, where you can verify that you have, so your only lambda just is the wave function of the quantum
state.
And so there's a view that in that case you can, but in a hidden variable theory you can't, towards that in both cases you don't have direct access to the states.
Well, if you cannot, if your view is that you cannot, verify also the quantum states, then it's even worse, in some sense. But definitely is not worried about it. The last point that I said, it should be surprising, because probability is not about ontological things. It's just about policing your ignorance. So it's completely neutral with respect to, what would be the ontology and whatever. So definitely could, as a realist about event, could believe in non-locality, for instance. But when he talks about probability, it's a different issue.
Is verifiability understood subjectively in the sense that for you to have probabilities, you have to regard something as verifiable rather than their being verifiable?
Yes.
Okay.
Because the basis is always subjective. So for the finite, even symmetry is subjective. It's subjective. That's the reason why changeability is the main notion. So it's always, you tell me that the physical structure of the coin, that's irrelevant. It's always given you subjective symmetry, which is reflected in exchangeability or partial, you have your judgment.
So is verifiability coming in two different ways? I'm thinking about those holes in the probability space where E12, H12 don't exist.
Yes.
Now that can be because the joint event is not verifiable.
Yes.
Or could it also be because maybe the joint event is verifiable, it's observational, but the joint probability is not verifiable?
No, the probability could not be verifiable because probability are not in the world.
Okay.
It's just probability, just opinion. Think about it as a totally subjective opinion.
Okay, so the verification comes through the events.
Yes. Yes, because probability, there is no meaning to say, probability is true or false, except for saying that your true degree of belief is something, and that's your psychological state.
So I have a question concerning your second point there.
Yeah.
I wonder whether even within, on the slide before. No, sorry, the last slide.
The
last
slide.
So it seems to me there is a way to motivate factorizability within a subjective probability, namely some kind of coherence between background beliefs about causation and your probability assignments. So if you have certain standard beliefs about causation, it seems to me that you will be constrained in the sorts of probabilities you assign. So, for example, you know, if there are three events, A, B, and C, and I think that, you know, C is the common cause of A and B, then it seems to me the probabilities I assign to them should be such that A and B are conditionally independent given C. And if A and B are not conditionally independent given C, then haven't I violated this background assumption that C is the cause of A and B?
I mean, it sounds very intuitive, and I would probably do the same, but you're implicitly assuming that there is something in your non-probabilistic beliefs that reflect on the probabilistic belief and constrain that, no?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what the finite tells you not to do. I mean, you know, you can do it psychologically and it's okay, but then under reflection and criticism, the question is whether it stands. I mean, so you're right. I mean, probably also the finite would do that. But that doesn't mean that it really justifies, motivating the sense of justifying, I mean, factor's ability as a locality condition. Because at the end of the day, your probabilities are not supposed to reflect anything in the world. Frequency is not probability, for instance. It's not.
I could assign a probability to a particular causal structure. I could say, my opinion of causal structure is this.
Yes.
And then I would have to have coherence between my opinions about causal structure and my opinions about these three events. So couldn't I have a coherence argument that would get me to factorizability in that sort of way?
I mean, if you can give a dashbook, then yes. Yes.
I think that might be the answer.
Might be. If you can show me that a situation in which there is a Dutch book, then yes.
But it can never verify the causal structure.
Pardon?
The causal structures that it first has some beliefs about would not be probabilities in this sense, since they are not verified. They are not events.
Yeah, well, it depends what you think about what is a causal structure. I mean, that's an ambiguous. I mean, if you think normally as philosophers think like counterfactual or these things, it's probably not.
Yeah, I'm very confused by your answer. I mean, every time you apply the conditions of coherence include normalization probabilities, and that assumes you have given a list of possible exclusive outcomes, and your use of that condition assumes that you are confident that your list of exclusive outcomes is correct, and of course that could always be incorrect. So you could always make a critique of, you know, how do you know that where that is something else comes, you know, down the light cone and smashes your experiment or comes into your experiment or something like that. So there's always, in your background assumptions, there's always physical assumptions that tell you that you're confident that you have a complete list of exclusive outcomes. So if you allow that, if you don't allow that, you can't do, even on these terms, any specification of probabilities or coherence. And once you allow that, why don't you allow what Rob says he wants to allow?
Well, I have to think again about the second paragraph. I think it's easier to argue against lambda independence, but more, I can see that it's more tricky. But
it's true that you can't verify things variables in bubbles. So take the double space experiment, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You have some particles impinging on a double state, one at a time, each pair in the same state. You know the state, you can't think because you know the preparations states. And then the particles go through and then they get a spin at the back. And you can measure directly what the positions of the particles are. So at any given time, you know both the distribution of particles. You can use the equations, you know, or just at that time measure them. And you also know what the quantum state is. I think you can, if you believe the Bohm interpretation, but I think for an ensemble of systems, you can actually measure both, so they are verifiable. Of course, you have to believe the interpretation.
Okay.
I mean, I often criticize calling these hidden variables hidden.
Yeah.
Because in a sense, the past positions are actually the things you measure, those are the things you
You can measure. You can measure, but then can you also verify the states? I mean, you're saying. I mean, the following. You're saying, I prepare the state, so I know what the state is.
Yeah, and you.
But you need to verify. You know, the preparation is some, like what we call some causal action or something. You manipulate something. You need to be verify it, and I'm not sure that you can verify. If you want to verify what your quantum state is, you have to make some measurement. That's the minimum. And then if you make such a measurement, if you want to measure the position, for instance, you change the quantum state. If you make some measurement that will give you some idea about the quantum state, you might change the position.
But can also say just immediately before the particles hit the screen.
Yeah.
I know the particles don't move too fast, so I know where they were. If they hit the screen at some point, I know where they were just an instant before.
Okay.
And also the quantum state, like calculation, but it will move on the back stage.
Yeah. I have to think about it again. I mean, I suppose that the problem is that verification. I mean, verification is kind of ambiguous, as I said, and definitely because it's not only instrumentalist and subjectivist, it's also pragmatic. Pragmatist. So it doesn't care. I mean, for him, at the end of the day, if you can work with it, I mean, it's not philosophical at that point. So I suppose that at the end of the day, I mean, it really depends how you verify things. And if you are like back about it, I suppose that you can do it.
I'm a little lost because it seems to be this confusion. You say that verifiability is just part of the probability theory, but then we're talking about making measurements and doing real things.
Yes.
So is there some sort of correspondence between those? I mean, can I think of verifiability as suppose I'm reasoning about the conjunction of two events. Can verifiability just be thought of as some belief that I have that these two events are mutually exclusive, therefore, to be coherent, I have to assign zero probability to that conjunction?
I think what he means by verifiability that you have some procedure that would allow you to verify whether you believe it's true or false.
So something you could do to convince yourself that this was okay.
Yes.
But
you mean to decide whether your assignment is?
It's not just observation. It's not just observation. For instance, the example that Lucien gave about the particle. If it's good for you as a measurement verification that if you see the particle hitting the screen at a certain point, then it means that it was very close to this point before, then it is. You verify by looking at the screen. You verify. I mean, the hypothesis that the particle was just on the trajectory near the screen before and not came from minus infinity. So that sort of things. I mean, is for him, but it's an ambiguous notion.
Also, this lambda independence. There's Luca Manna here, who's not here now, but I think he's coming back on Tuesday. I think I maybe paraphrase his argument, but I don't want to put words in his mouth. That if you assume determinism, then this assumption of lambda independence is just simply a logical contradiction. Because you're, in general, knowing the detector settings and the outcomes should give you information about lambda. There's no logical reason to assume that somehow that probability, the close to probability distributions are equal, the one where you just ignore that information and the one where you keep it.
I think that's, I don't know. I mean, I think that this claim is controversial because, for instance, Bell, who, had Bohm's theory in mind, thought that he can still talk about lambda independence, and it's not a contradiction. he talked about the situation in which you have superdeterminism.
Well, certainly, if you had this idea of superdeterminism, then that would imply that there's this independence. But that's only that implication doesn't go the other way. Just because I leave that, just because I don't have this assumption, doesn't imply superdeterminism.
Well, I mean, first of all, in subjective probability, the fact that there is a determinism doesn't mean that you cannot have the distribution, because that's the normal situation, not only in quantum mechanics, statistical mechanics, for instance. It's totally deterministic theory, but you can still talk about your ignorance about which state is the initial state. No?
Sure. Yeah.
So that's the same in Bohm. I don't see why there is any problem here.
No.
It's really neutral to the question of determinism or indeterminism. No?
Well, if you really believe in strong superdeterminism at that level, you're not allowed to reason about the separation when you're doing experimenting to what are the laws you're identifying and what are the initial conditions. And if you're not allowed to do that, there's an awful lot of physics in that life.
Yeah, superdeterminism is much worse than non locality.
So
much more fundamental. The violation of superdeterminism. Well, the assumption is much more fundamental to any physics that we do.
None of you have said what superdeterminism means. I mean, you have this criterion lambda that's throwing around superdeterminism.
Well, no, superdeterminism means, the way I understand, is that you cannot assume that, for instance, that the measurement settings are external variable. And that doesn't matter. I mean, even if you have ontology that tells you that everything is determined by the Big Bang, for instance, it still doesn't mean that you have superdeterminism, because if you can for all your needs, I mean, you can treat them as external variable, then you don't have superdeterminism. Because superdeterminism is not about determinism; it's about the ability to manipulate or to think about them.
It's something that are viable. But I take it that there's an issue here that I'm not sure if this group is getting at, that there's already a tension in any, or even in ordinary physical theories, between having, so Newtonian physics is deterministic. So it's deterministic. I mean, that Tuck makes this point too when he's using variable theories. What do you mean when you say you have freedom to manipulate the experimental apparatus, the detector settings? You know, the setting, it's already determined. So you have to, I think there's some, it's not at all trivial just to sort of open up a notion of what you mean, but a notion of freedom in the context of a deterministic or stochastic theory. So that's why, I mean, I thought that the lambda independence criterion just is a criterion on the probability distributions. Superdeterminism seems a little bit vague to me.
Yeah.
And I mean, it means it has very different connotations to different people.
I totally agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was a point that I forgot to mention, if you allow me like 30 seconds or a minute, that is important actually. Some advantages of the finetic approach. If you go with the finetic, remember that the problem, if you go with classical probability, and you always get this as a theorem of probability, then if you assume mirror, that this probability mirror this probability, and you assume lambda independence, then you are immediately committed to this inequality. But in definitely, you can assume mirror, and you can assume lambda independence, if you can, motivate it, and you won't get this inequality.
What was the first thing you can assume?
You can assume mirror. You can assume that probability of alpha.
I don't understand the word. Mirror?
Mirror, yeah. I call it mirror because it's this assumption. That for each outcome, the distribution of outcome just reflect the distribution of whatever it means. I mean, it's not so easy to make sense of that, but in I mean, whatever if you go with classical subjective probability theory, and for me definite is not totally classical, then if you assume this assumption that the probability of outcome, distribution of outcome, reflect the distribution of the spin, and you assume lambda independence, then you immediately committed to the Bell-Clausen-Horn inequalities that are violated in the experiment. But in definitely, you can still make this assumption and not be committed to this. So, and all you have to know, you don't have to know quantum mechanics, all you have to know that you cannot jointly verify A and A prime and B and B prime. That's all you need. In everything else, I mean, you know, it's just assumption that you make. I mean, and you know, you don't know much about Bell theorem and all these things, and still you're not going to. So it seems to me that this notion of verifiability is actually something that is good for your rationality, instrumental rationality.
Even if you don't want to be as subjective as to extent, there's something right about requiring something like verifiability for the events to which you want to attribute probabilities. If you go back to probability being a guide to life, then it's only a guide to life when, you know, when life moves along a bit that you know whether the guide that led you correctly or not. So you need some sort of verifiability in there, even if you're not a positivist or subjectivist.
I totally agree. I'm not definitely. I believe in objective probability, but I think that this is a good idea.
So there are standard arguments against verifiability as the demarcation between what's scientific and what's not. And in the context of probability theory, I would have thought in science, you know, all the time as we make inferences between two verifiable things, we go through unverifiable things, right? So I can have a logical deduction where some of the things are unverifiable in the middle, and you know, logical deduction is just a one aspect of probability theory. So are you in support of DeFinetti's use of the verification principle as criterion for the appropriateness of assigning probabilities to anything? Because
no.
A lot of what we do in science is not right according to this.
I mean, I'm more qualified in the sense that I mean, Richard mentioned that I think that especially when you don't know what's going on and you cannot verify two things together, by giving a joint probability to them, you commit yourself, you restrict your probability more than I think you should. But I don't think that I'm not in favor of positivist science in the sense that, you know, if I cannot see you, I cannot observe. I mean, it's verifiability, I think, should be much more flexible in that sense. So I have sympathy. I mean, I'm not a positivist and I'm not subjectivist. But I think that there is something wise in being careful and instead of just distributing your probability, suspending judgment. Because that's basically, I mean, saying, you know, I don't want to have a coherent judgment. You can have a judgment, degrees of belief that's psychological, it's beyond me. When it comes to probabilities, I can decide there is no probability. I can still do my science, I can still give probability to A and B, but I don't give probability to A and B.
I think the lambda independence is a nice example of where I would want to attribute a probability, unlike Divinity according to you,
yeah.
Because it plays an indirect role in generating probabilities for verifiable things later on.
Yeah. It's a problem. I mean, it's a very fine line, because also if you think about Divinity is subjectivist. And being subjectivist, the question is, for the Finetti, probability theory is some, you know, coherent degrees of belief on the logic. But first you have to find, and it's about uncertain events. So first you have to find what are the certain events. Construct your domain of uncertainty. I talk a little bit in the paper about it. And then have probabilities. Now, because you're subjectivist, I mean, you might be incoherent in your domain of, you know, logic. And then you build probability theory on that. it is kind of tricky. But he is, in a sense, that's his commitment. I don't want to go all the way to this commitment, but I think he's, in a sense, this is his commitment. So in order to have probabilities, first you have to know what's certain and uncertain, and that would require a lot of inductions that you either cannot do, or you might well make mistakes. But it seems to me that it's, I don't see why you have to distribute over A and A prime, for instance, in order to do science, if you cannot verify. You can do a lot of physics, and you can also, I mean, in that case, if you don't follow the finite, and I think that the finite would be a bit hesitant, I mean, to derive Bell theorem, but you can still derive Bell theorem, the Bell inequalities. But I don't know, I mean, it's kind of intuition, but in this paper was more philosophical reflection, it's not a, I'm not committed to any of the things.
Thanks. Sorry to go for lunch so much.